Welcome back to The Investment Conversation. I'm Tony Fisher. As equity investors contend with heightened volatility in this new decade, we believe at Lord Abbett there will be a premium on original research, insights, and portfolio agility. In this new podcast series, The Active Investor, our intent is to dig into what matters most across different segments of the equity markets, to better understand risk factors and portfolio applications, and how active management can uncover opportunity and manage risk for a long-term investor. So let's kick things off with our host, Lord Abbett Investment Strategist, Brian Forrester.
This is Brian Forrester, and welcome to the Active Investor Podcast, part of Lord Abbett's Investment Conversation Series. I'm an equity investment strategist, and I've been with Lord Abbett now for 10 years, and I started my career in the industry in 1995. And a big part of my job, aside from flying around the globe to meet with clients, is studying the equity markets, the long-term behaviors, the risk factors, how changing market dynamics influence stock prices, and really where some of the big megatrends are building. And so today's episode fits right in there. As it's going to focus on a topic that we are hearing a lot of investors grapple with, and that's the current state of the tech revolution, and specifically a concept we've been discussing with many of our institutional clients and the professional buyer community, what we've been calling the innovation premium. And in the two papers that we've attached to this podcast, we get more deeply into this risk-based explanation for why innovation stocks have been outperforming over the long run. And it's primarily the mispricing of the risk associated with these companies that are spending or investing intensely in R&D or research and development. Our innovation team here at Lord Abbett continues to see from both a bottom-up and industry data perspective that the pace of technological disruption continues to result in enormous organic growth in areas like genomics, fintech, e-commerce, artificial intelligence, cloud computing, and many other areas. But if you look at the stock price performance recently in these areas, you would think that there's a rapid deceleration happening. You might even say this is the tech wreck from 2000 to 2002 all over again. So here with me today to talk about some of these topics is one of Lord Abbett's innovation growth portfolio managers, Ben Abel. Ben, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Brian. It's good to be here.
So Ben has been in the industry now for 25 years, researching and investing in technology stocks since the 1990s, and certainly saw the boom and bust period back then. But he also saw the huge promise from the technological innovations that led to such high expectations back then. A lot of it emanating from the power of the internet and the huge gains that were to come from areas like the cloud to automation to AI. And today, the big difference from, say, 1999 is the massive adoption and monetization that really was not there 20 years ago. And so Ben is here today with me to talk about a few things. We'll talk valuations, large caps and small caps, the big pullback we've seen of late, particularly among growth stocks, thematic versus fundamental investing, and a concept we call operating momentum. But the first topic is this idea of an innovation risk premium, and specifically the concept of R&D intensity. And in the two papers that we'll reference in this podcast, we get more deeply into this risk-based explanation for why innovation stocks have been outperforming over the long run. And it's primarily the mispricing of the risk associated with these companies that are spending or investing intensely in R&D or research and development. What we show is that for a long period of time, the top decile of companies in the US equity market ranked by R&D intensity, meaning they spend the most on R&D relative to last year's sales. So on average, these companies are delivering about three times the revenue growth and almost four times the earnings growth. And as a result, these stocks have delivered anywhere from 17 to 27 percentage point excess return over the stock market, depending on the time period. And that was over the course of the subsequent 3 years, even though they held valuation premiums. So essentially, it's a rolling three-year study of return on R&D. And what's most relevant here is that the stocks and their earnings power are just being chronically and substantially underestimated. The story is that companies that reinvest are taking risk, but the market is woefully mispricing this risk. And it is risk. Let's be clear. These companies are not holding cash. Most aren't paying a dividend or buying back their stock. They're reinvesting in some technologies or expansion, some project that can potentially drive more growth or cannibalize a competitor's market share, sometimes even their own, to drive much deeper incumbency. And again, the market is chronically missing the magnitude of this return for those R&D dollars. And in the longer piece, we go into what is driving a lot of this misunderstanding, the, let's call it, displacement risk that less agile businesses are facing. The poorly forecasted pace of disruption in many industries. So after you hear Ben today, we would encourage you to have a read. So Ben, how do you think about this idea of R&D intensity when you are trying to find stocks of great innovators?
Thanks, Brian. You know, it's a pretty straightforward formula. Like you said, those companies have very high R&D intensity. So the level of R&D spend that they have relative to their revenues is large. That should be translating into higher revenue growth. Now, one of the important concepts here is the ability to sustain that high R&D intensity, right? You can go to the market, you can borrow money, you can sell your stock, but if you're not eventually driving that revenue growth off of those R&D dollars, it's not sustainable. So having above average revenue growth then allows you to now have, you know, the gross dollars to plow back into the business and sustain that R&D. That drives higher earnings. So let me just pause there, right? Not a novel concept. I didn't invent this, but it's motherhood and apple pie. Stocks equals earnings expectations, right? No matter whether you're a Dun & Graham investor or you're an innovation growth investor, earnings drive stocks. And so we think about the R&D dollars getting translated into outsized revenue growth and that driving, just like you said before, or earnings that are significantly higher, might be a magnitude higher. And so that drives stock performance. That's our investment philosophy. Earnings equals stocks. And so we have an investment process around that to try and find the attributes that help us find bottom up those stocks that can, or those companies that can convey that R&D dollars into higher revenue growth and become great stocks.
So that's interesting. So let's go a little bit deeper there. So what kind of markets do you tend to look at when it comes to competitiveness? And what I mean by that is really, do you want to be in more competitive markets? Do you want these companies to be in more competitive markets? Or is it better to find a company where they can, you know, there's not a lot of competition, where they can just sort of dominate?
First, let's appreciate that converting R&D dollars into outsized revenue growth is likely different for different industries. And so at Lord Abbett on the innovation growth team, you know, we've got, you know, five veteran savvy stock pickers who are essentially sector PMs, and they all have a formula on how to find that. Within tech, in the area of TMT that I'm responsible for, I actually like businesses that are in competitive industry. Don't get, you know, technology companies don't get a 20-year patent life on their R&D like big pharma, right? They have to go out and they have to demonstrate that they should be the de facto standard that gets, you know, adopted by the industry. But the rewards for that are phenomenal, right? And there's great examples of a company becoming the de facto operating system for, you know, computers, or becoming the de facto smartphone for, you know, 1.5 billion users. And so industries that are actually more competitive, where those dollars have to be translated into those market share gains and into that dominant position, it's a winner-take-all market, often in technology, which is why investing in tech stocks is so exciting, because you can get those kind of economics on the backside, right? Where as a market evolves, the company that had that high R&D intensity, and again, that R&D dollar has to be successfully allocated, otherwise it's not going to convert into revenues, right? If they've done that R&D allocation correctly and they've, you know, deepened their presence in the market, those companies often have 60, 70% market share and really, you know, just drive dominant economics as the incumbent in, you know, the technology as it gets adopted across, you know, its customer base.
You know, I've heard you talk about having generally a preference for profitability, right? But as you go down in market cap, finding companies with profits gets harder. Does that matter? Do you think differently about earlier stage companies, you know, in having a preference for positive earnings? Is it more difficult, you know, when looking at some of these earlier stage names?
Great question. I think at the end of the day, we're always talking about normalized earnings. And that could be for a company who has today an 8% operating margin. And the expectation is once they grow, you know, their installed base, those revenues, those units, and then they're spending less incremental dollars, their margins go from 18% to theoretically 30%, right? 30% normalized, you know, margins. That's not any different than a small cap company who maybe is at break even because they just don't have the scale yet. They're still early in their development, but we're expecting them to go from 0% margins to 20% normalized. So sometimes it's a little more obvious for the larger companies just because you have the evidence today. Our approach is to think about the growth in their customer base, their units have a much greater upside. And if on top of that, you know, they can also have better mix so that the prices of those units are higher, then that drives that outsized revenue growth that you were referring to before. Again, conveying that R&D dollars, whether you're a microcap company or, you know, whether you're Microsoft and you're reallocating, you know, whether you're a company that, you know, is dominant in a certain area of software that's mostly on-prem and the world is going to cloud, and all of a sudden you start to reallocate your investment dollars from, you know, a gross margin business of 60% to a gross margin business today of zero. Like, you have to go through that trade-off decision on your R&D dollars either way, depending upon. And so again, we think about what normalized earnings look like in those situations.
And, you know, you mentioned gross margins, and in that study that's in these white papers, a lot of these high R&D intensity companies have great gross margins, but they also may have low or negative net income. And, you know, that's partly because of that big R&D expense that's on the income statement. And that can be very potent with innovation and can drive a lot of future revenue growth, as you're kind of pointing out. On the flip side, critics will, you know, cite the higher PE valuations of stocks in, let's say, you know, SaaS or software as a service or cloud software or AI chip companies. The largest AI chip company out there, in fact, has a PE north of 40 times next year's earnings. And that's even after this big drawdown. So that can still seem very high compared to the broader market. How do you think about valuation in some of these names?
Again, as I talked about before, if you're thinking about earnings power and you're thinking about normalized margins off of a higher revenue base, we're thinking about traditional, you know, multiples 3 to 5 years out, and then we discount it back, which might get you to what looks like a high, you know, multiple. But what we like to say is there's no such thing as expensive stocks, just poor estimates. And those aren't expensive stocks. They're just high PEs that, to your earlier point, reflect the premium for their ability to successfully allocate those dollars. You know, the reason why gross margins showing up now for companies is a lot of their fixed costs are not in PP&E, physical plant and equipment, right? The world's gone from where fossil fuels were the source of energy to now it's the brain power. While those dollars aren't in, you know, factories, they're in your people, they're in your engineers, they're in your sales folks who are out there prospecting. So those fixed costs are in R&D, and those fixed costs are also in sales and marketing. And so the gross margin, again, it's just one way of thinking about it. But at the end of the day, it's got to drive free cash flow. It's got to drive a normalized, you know, kind of a free cash flow. And I, you know, remember I was about 12 years into the business. It was an earnings conference call. A CEO of a well-known graphics chip company that at the time was only doing graphic chips, but today their chips are being used for things like AI and machine learning and things not, you know, appreciated back in the early 2000s. I remember where a sell-sider challenged the CEO on the earnings call that his operating margins were too low. They were running around 12% and that they should be higher, up around 18 to 20%. and that he should stop investing so aggressively in his business. And the CEO responded and said, look, I'm trying to build this business for the long term. Now, I know every CEO says that, and then the question becomes whether or not they're making those allocation decisions correctly, right? But his point was, I've got these products, they're going to be cannibalized. So I have a choice. Either I can cannibalize them or let somebody else do it. I'm going to do it myself. And that's why we're spending so aggressively, because we do see a path of adoption of these chips and these use cases where we don't have revenue dollars today for the adjacent use case, but we see that. And we have a vision of how these graphic chips are going to go from just playing games to doing things like weather simulation and applications that we just don't appreciate yet, but that's the power of computing. And so he had a vision. The stock was at 10 bucks, split adjusted $2.50, and now it's just north of 200, right? He had a very clear vision of how his R&D dollars were going to translate into a market that was adjacent to what he was doing, but he could usurp it into it. And the other thing that I learned about 7 years into my career, I was talking to a CFO and I kind of asked the same question. Why are you striving for 20% operating margins? You know, is that just so that you've got earnings that are here and we'll put this multiple on it and your stock will go higher? He said, no, it's not that. He goes, I'm trying to force discipline on the R&D allocation, because every engineer that works for me thinks that his project is the next great project. Every salesman that works for me thinks that his lead is the next great lead. And so by having a level at which we think forces difficult decisions, not between right and wrong, but between right and right, like that forces us to make good decisions about where to allocate those dollars and build depth of incumbency. And that really resonated with me about how to think about what they were doing. Just like I was looking across my portfolio and I was trying to allocate my dollars to the best stocks, what I thought would be the best stocks, right? It's the same concept to me about, you know, allocation of limited resources.
You know, kind of on a related topic, I'm pretty sure no one at Lord Abbett uses the words operating momentum more than you do. So tell me what you mean by that, that term, and how you also think about the technical side of the equation, price momentum. So how do you kind of as a practitioner think about these tools?
So I've really been lucky. I've worked for some really thoughtful investors as my lead PMs over time. And when we talked about fundamentals, we talked about the ability for a company to demonstrate the return of its investments. So one of our favorite things to do when we're talking to a company and they're explaining our strategy is to ask them, great, how is that showing up in the P&L? How is that showing up in the balance sheet? Where's the evidence of those returns, right? My kid thinks that, you know, he's doing really well in middle school. Well, I get a report card, you know, every couple of months to show me whether or not he's on track. And so in the same way that, you know, when your kid gets a C on his report card and you say, okay, now we've got to focus on, you know, a little more time in math and executing in some of this, we're looking at the same type of operating momentum. We're looking for the evidence and the results that the company is driving the return or the path to the return on those revenue dollars. That's a very difficult conversation, right? Because we're trying to extrapolate in the future about what that R&D dollars will provide. In any given earnings report, there's some macro transitory effects, right? The macro conditions always impact a company. It's just a question at what level, right? And then there's company specific drivers. And so we try and sort out what's transitory versus what's structural, and that how that structural force can then relate into secular drivers. And that's our concept of operating momentum. And so we want to find companies that have operating momentum so that we can see breadcrumbs and evidence that they're on that path to the higher normalized earnings that we talked about. However, another thing that I learned about, you know, 12 years into my career was if I'm the only person in the world that sees it, then I'm not making money for my clients. And I haven't done a good job of allocating the dollars. And that's where starting to use price momentum really is important. That's an analysis unto itself for us, just like fundamental analysis. And what we do is we combine operating momentum with technical price momentum. Where we see operating momentum, we think the things that are driving it are sustainable and will lead to some earnings power higher than people think and for longer. And we see the price momentum that says that other people see it as well. And that's how we think about trying to own stocks. At the end of the day, you know, what we're doing is owning stocks. And it's an important part of our process because it's about not owning companies, but owning stocks. And that's what active management is about.
So look, over the long term, no doubt stocks equal companies and companies equal stocks. But in a shorter time frame, it's about the life cycle of the stock itself. And in order to win, you need to get the stocks right, not just the companies. It's a statement of active management. That's how we think about it.
Yeah, you know, you say that very casually, Ben, but that's actually a pretty different way that you hear portfolio managers talk about investing. I think there's a lot of dogma that says, you know, first and foremost, you own companies, and it's almost like the stock's not relevant. You're kind of saying that owning the stock is really what is critical to success in active management. It's a very unique view. And, you know, I think related to that, I'm not sure if you're aware of this, Ben, but there's some ETFs out there that invest in innovation. In fact, one big one in particular has raked in, you know, billions of dollars in the last few years, especially in 2020. And they almost unabashedly call themselves thematic investors. And those ETFs and some other mutual funds that are focused on investing in innovation have had a pretty harsh drawdown over the last year or so. Some are down 50 to 70% from their peak. So I'll ask you this. Are you a thematic investor?
No, I would not call myself a thematic investor. I would call myself a bottom-up stock picking. That's how we go out trying to think about building a portfolio. We don't start out by saying we want to own this sector or that sector. We don't start out by saying we want to own this theme or that theme. We go to wherever the operating momentum resides that I talked about before and wherever that price momentum resides. And that's how we find the best stocks. Because of that, we end up getting to the right sectors, the right industry overweights, the right themes, as it was, but for the right reason. I think sometimes what happens is that when you're thinking about a theme and you're so focused on betting on a theme that you end up, you know, riding it out and thinking more about the theme than the stock. And again, it's all about owning a stock and active management and trying to drive alpha. The other way I like to think about that is, how many themes are there that are really investable? A handful each year. But if you think about it, you probably have a good 20, 30, 40 stocks each year that are really investable. If you think about it, then over a 2-year period, a 3-year period, you have 60 to 90 stocks that you're bottom up that you're focused on. And so that gives you 100 swings at the bat. And if we're looking for fat pitches, again, companies that have that revenue dynamic that you talked about, where they're converting the R&D dollars into outsized revenue growth, then we think that that's a good sample set for us to play the laws of probability, which again, when you're trying to build a bottom up portfolio, you think about. So focusing on themes, that just doesn't work for the way we like to try and make money.
Got it. And so, okay, one last question. It's probably the one that's on everyone's mind. So this past year has been definitely some rough sledding for growth in particular. And after 2020 kind of made everyone a believer in innovation investing, it seems like many are now questioning it. And, you know, there are definitely legitimate concerns out there in the world. We have 8% inflation prints, more rate hikes are coming, a war in Ukraine that no one really saw coming last year, and a threat of recession now. So with all that going on, is innovation still a good place to be for investors?
I definitely think it is. And I think it is for two reasons. One is a context. The context is any successful investment is going to go through drawdowns. It's part of investing in general. We've lived through many instances that are challenging, and you can't build a portfolio that works every day, but you can build a portfolio of, you know, 40, 60, 70 great names that in any year you could find some monster stocks. And what's usually an attribute that drives, again, that R&D intensity converting into revenue dollars is attributes where that company is an enabler. They're bringing something to the game to help their customer. Doesn't matter whether it's an enterprise customer or a consumer customer. And in technology, that enablement is all about automation. It's about productivity tools. So if you look at an environment where there's inflation,
you know, that's a fantastic place for a company to try and automate, to try and drive their costs down, drive costs, you know, out of the picture, reduce the number of steps. So again, they're using productivity tools, which is what innovative technology is all about. And with the ability for a company to do that in technology, what is really interesting is there's so many great examples of where that company ends up getting predominant market share, 60, 65% market share. So if you think about a market that's growing and you think about them taking share, they become the de facto standard in the industry, which is great because then they can continue to innovate. They can continue to try and cannibalize themselves before somebody else does, and they can get the lion's share of those markets, which drives that outsized revenue growth, eventually turns into outsized earnings growth that we were talking about. So I think in any kind of environment, there's always room for innovation to help drive productivity.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, you've seen what stocks have gone down the most. It's the ones that, you know, sort of have what's called equity duration, right? They're the longest, the most sensitivity to two higher interest rates, which is related to inflation. And yet many of those same companies looking ahead could be exactly, do exactly what you just mentioned, be the ones that could help to solve for inflation, even though they've had this big drawdown because of the rate part of the equation. Anyway, thanks for joining us, Ben. This has been great stuff, and I think it's been a valuable look at innovation investing and what we're seeing today, you know, really from transformative and technologically innovative companies and their stocks in what has been a volatile market. But there is clearly a lot of big potential from the tech revolution over the next decade, and so important to be able to identify the winners as they emerge and prove out their potential. Again, for listeners wanting to learn more about Lord Abbett's views on innovation, we'd encourage you to read the two white papers that I referenced a few times in this podcast. You can find both of them on the Insights section of lordabbett.com. And the two titles of those papers, the first one, How the Innovation Premium Has Changed Equity Investing. And the second one is Amid Market Volatility, Innovation Maintains Its Edge. And so we'll leave it there. This has been the Active Investor Podcast, and thank you for listening.
Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite streaming app of choice. Thank you for listening. AI refers to artificial intelligence. The concept of equity duration focuses on a company's future expected cash flows, earnings, and dividends, and calculating the impact of a rising discount rate on the present value of those values, and then, theoretically, the current value of the stock. Graham Dodd, Value Investing, is focused on deriving the intrinsic value of a common stock independent of its market price. Market cannibalization is a loss in sales caused by a company's introduction of a new product that displaces one of its own older products. Normalized earnings refer to adjustments made to financial statements to eliminate one-off effects that may impact revenue. A stock's P/E ratio is its share price divided by its earnings per share for the past 12 months. The forward P/E ratio is a current stock's price over its forecasted earnings per share for the following 12 months. P&L refers to a company's profit and loss statements. Sell-side firms are intermediaries whose task is to sell securities to investors. The tech wreck refers to the sell-off in technology shares that occurred in the year 2000. TMT refers to technology, media, and telecom stocks. The turnover ratio is the percentage of a mutual fund or other portfolio's holdings that have been replaced in a given year. The turnover ratio is the percentage of a mutual fund or other portfolio's holdings that have been replaced in a given calendar year or whichever 12-month period represents the fund's fiscal year. Mentions of specific companies are for reference purposes only and are not meant to describe the investment merits of, or potential, or actual portfolio changes related to securities of those companies.
Unless otherwise noted,
All discussions are based on U.S. markets and U.S. monetary and fiscal policies. The credit quality of the securities in a portfolio is assigned by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization, or NSRO, such as Standard & Poor's, Moody's, or Fitch, as an indication of an issuer's creditworthiness. Ratings range from AAA, which is the highest, to D, which is the lowest. Bonds rated BBB or above are considered investment grade. Credit ratings BB and below are lower rated securities, or junk bonds. High yielding, non-investment grade bonds, or junk bonds, involve higher risks than investment grade bonds. Adverse conditions may affect the issuer's ability to pay interest and principal on these securities. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. The value of investments in fixed income securities will change as interest rates fluctuate and in response to market movements. Generally, when interest rates rise, the price of debt securities fall, and when interest rates fall, prices generally rise. The municipal market can be affected by adverse tax, legislative, or political changes, and by the financial condition of the issuers of municipal securities. Investments in non-U.S. or emerging market securities, which may be adversely affected by economic, political, or regulatory factors and subject to currency volatility and greater liquidity risk. The value of investments in equity securities will fluctuate in response to general economic conditions and changes in prospects of particular companies and/or sectors in the economy. No investing strategy can overcome all market volatility or guarantee future results. Market forecasts and projections are based on current market conditions and subject to change without notice. Projections should not be considered a guarantee. The views and opinions expressed by the Lord Abbott speaker are those of the speaker as of the date of the broadcast and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm as a whole. Any such views are subject to change at any time based upon market conditions or other conditions, and Lord Abbott disclaims any responsibility to update such views. This material is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, or investment advice. It is not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities or to adopt any investment strategy. Neither Lord Abbott nor the Lord Abbott speaker can be responsible for any direct or incidental loss incurred by applying any of the information offered. The information provided is not directed at any investor or category of investors and is provided solely as general information about Lord Abbott's products and services and to otherwise provide general investment education. None of the information provided should be regarded as a suggestion to engage in or refrain from any investment-related course of action, as neither Lord Abbott nor its affiliates are undertaking to provide impartial investment advice, act as an impartial advisor, or give advice in a fiduciary capacity. If you are an individual retirement investor, contact your financial advisor or other fiduciary about whether any given instrument, idea, strategy, product, or service may be appropriate for your circumstances. This broadcast is copyright 2021 of Lord Abbott & Co., LLC. All rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or in any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Lord Abbott Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbott Distributor, LLC. This broadcast is copyright 2022 of Lord Abbott & Co., LLC. All rights reserved. This recording may not be reproduced in whole or in part or in any form without the permission of Lord Abbott. Lord Abbott Mutual Funds are distributed by Lord Abbott Distributor, LLC.